Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled Death Knell Arrives for Penny Production by Obin Abekyokin. Then Heather Haddon and Laura Cooper wrote, These drinks will sober you up. $15 mocktails are a real buzzkill. Definitely gouging. Brianna Abbott wrote, Chronic disease is biggest scourge in American health. And then Peter Loftus has, Ozempic for everyone, doctors hail GLP-1s. And we'll follow that up with an article by Bob Green, Billy Joel's Last Moment of Obscurity. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first, Death Knell Arrives for Penny Production. The United States government is phasing out the penny, whose use has spanned more than two centuries. The Treasury Department will stop putting new pennies into circulation by early next year. Afterward, there won't be enough pennies to use in everyday cash transactions, and businesses will need to start rounding up or down to the nearest 5 cents, the Treasury said. The move is the culmination of a long bipartisan effort to do away with the lowest denomination unit of American currency, which is more likely to end up lost or buried under couch cushions than to be used for transactions. President Trump has been critical of the penny, as was President Barack Obama. Trump, in a social media post back in February, asked the Treasury to halt penny production. Since then, bills to stop its production have been introduced in both chambers of Congress. The United States Mint, which is the Treasury's in-house coin producer, projects an annual savings of $56 million in reduced material costs. The penny, though worth only a cent, costs nearly 4 cents to make. The Treasury says it expects savings to grow once it stops using some of the production facilities. The Mint will stop making pennies after it runs out of the blank templates used to make them. The final order of blanks was placed late last month, according to the statement. Americans will still be able to use pennies in cash transactions after production stops. As pennies fade from circulation, businesses will have to adjust pricing. Non-cash transactions will continue to be priced at exact change. The Treasury said state and local governments should provide guidance to retailers so that sales tax are properly collected. Congress sets the rules for currency production, including the size and composition of coins, and it can discontinue or eliminate coins. But the Treasury said it has the power to halt the production of new coins. With production costs rising, the United States government lost more than $85 million last year on the roughly 3 billion pennies it produced. Meanwhile, Americans throw away up to $68 million in coins a year. They're left in plastic bins at airport security checkpoints and even used in art and home decor. Some 60% of actively circulating coins, or as much as $14 billion, sit in coin jars, according to the Federal Reserve. But the penny remains deeply embedded in American culture. Traders buy and sell penny stocks. Grandparents advised that a penny earned is a penny saved is a penny earned. Friends are eager to offer their 2 cents. The United States is following the footsteps of Canada, which stopped making the coin in 2012 and eventually started to round cash transactions to the nearest 5 cents. Australia and New Zealand stopped making one cent pieces decades ago. The United States penny was one of the first coins made by the mint after its establishment back in 1792. At the time, its design featured a woman with windswept hair. The penny has since shrunk in size, and its composition has changed from pure copper to a mix of zinc and copper. Back in 1909, Abraham Lincoln was first featured on the coin in honor of his 100th birthday, according to the Mint. And now, these drinks will sober you up. Clara Choi gets a funny feeling from the drinks she sips when she goes out with friends. The fruity, brightly colored concoctions typically incorporate juices and syrups. They contain no alcohol, but they still make Choi wince and leave her with a different kind of hangover. It might look pretty, but it's literally a layer of grape juice and orange juice, said Choi, a 30-year-old Southern California foodie working in higher education. They are definitely gouging. So-called mocktails are lingering in bar and restaurant menus long past dry January, into dry July, sober October, and beyond. More Americans are foregoing alcohol as they prioritize health over catching a buzz. Not wanting to be empty-handed, many of the sober or sober curious are ordering up non-alcoholic cocktails again. The concoction's high-proof price tags, though, are frustrating drinkers who are skeptical that the cost of syrup, sodas, and fake spirits can rival the real thing. Mina Wallace doesn't drink. The 24-year-old transcriptionist often orders Shirley Temples when she goes out and said some spots charge more than $10 for the mix of ginger ale, grenadine, and a mat and a cherry. That's steeper than some alcoholic drinks. The Australian native said she's sipping more lemonade and orange juice as a result. Businesses are probably losing money because I'm not having four espresso martinis a night, but I think some of the prices are just unjustifiable, Wallace said. Dan Hauser, 37, of Niles, Illinois, estimated that his roughly 10 months of sobriety had saved him more than $6,000 after he got wise to alcohol-free drinks pricing. You can't price them like that if they're even remotely close to the price of a real cocktail, Hauser said. He sticks to Topo Chico, Diet Coke, and iced tea. Roughly a 500,000 cases of non-alcoholic spirits were sold in the United States back in 2024, more than 10 times the amount sold 5 years earlier, according to global data and insights provider IWSR. Mocktail serves at bars and restaurants averaged $8.61 a drink at the end of last year, according to market research firm Technomic. That's up from the prior three-month period, but below the $13.43 average for cocktails. Bar owner say making libations with fake spirits does not come cheap. At the Understory Cocktail Bar in San Diego, mocktails go for around $15, a dollar less than the cheapest mixed drinks. The bar serves drinks with Seedlip and Ritual Zero Proof non-alcoholic liqueurs, which can cost the bar around $24 a bottle to purchase, said Chance Curtis, Understory General Manager. It's the same price as spirits. We have to price accordingly, Curtis said. In Philadelphia, Kavanaugh's Rittenhouse Sports Bar sells an acai U box gin drink and a phony Negroni for $8 and $12, respectively. The shots of St. Agrestis non-alcoholic spirits or Ritual Zero Proof gin alongside mixers cost the bar around $2 per drink, about the same as alcoholic versions. My staff thinks it's crazy, but it's a lifestyle choice. Mike Anderson, the sports bar's general manager, said of people going to bars and ordering pricey non-alcoholic drinks. Distillers say making virgin versions of tequila, gin, and whiskey is a process akin to alchemy. Ivan Saldana, a master distiller who has made 15 different foolproof spirits, said cracking the code on a distilled non-alcoholic blue agave spirit took about 2 years of trial and error. Ben Stratton, a 37-year-old physical therapist assistant from Michigan, said she prefers something less sweet than solely juice-based drinks. But for Stratton and her sister, who quit drinking, locating bars that serve mocktails like hunting down a speakeasy during prohibition. You have to rely on other people to find those places, she said. At Supperland in Charleston, North Carolina, the upscale restaurant and bar still sells juice-based drinks for $7, but now also with alcohol-free takes on gin and tonics and tropical drinks for between $12 and $16. Supperland recently added a non-alcoholic sparkling wine to its menu at $75 a bottle. Some customers have requested non-alcoholic options for Supperland tasting menu events, starting at $175 per person, so they don't feel left out with their drinking friends. People willing to spend that much on non-alcoholic cocktails is bananas, said Supperland beverage director Colleen Hughes. Jake Hopkins has curbed his drinking after 12 years of DJing and clubbing. Mocktail prices can definitely feel a bit like the bar is trying to juice you, said the 34-year-old working in artificial intelligence. But he's convinced that paying $13 to $15 for alcohol-free potions at places like Denver's Honey Elixir Bar is still a better deal than the alternative. The drinks always taste good, Hopkins said, and I never end up at a sketchy after party at 5 a.m. And now chronic disease is the biggest scourge in American health. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has made combating chronic disease a rallying cry as he looks to overhaul the health department and make America healthy again. So how healthy is America historically? It isn't that we used to be healthier, data shows, but the biggest threats have changed. The deadliest scourges in the United States were once infectious, with influenza and tuberculosis topping the list at the start of the 20th century. Better sanitation and advances in antibiotics and vaccines muzzled them, transforming America's well-being. Medical innovations and anti-smoking campaigns then spurred decades of progress against heart disease and cancer. But chronic diseases, persistent or long-lasting health conditions, are undermining that momentum, contributing to our stalled life expectancy over the past decade that trails behind that of other wealthy nations. Much of the gap in life expectancy is due to deaths among working-age adults, said Dr. Stephen Wolf, a life expectancy researcher at the Virginia Commonwealth University. Americans die earlier and are sicker than people in other high-income countries, he said. This has been true for a long time, and the trend is getting worse. Drug overdoses from opiates, alcohol, suicide, and chronic diseases drive most of those early deaths, researchers said. The United States also took a bigger hit from COVID-19, even among younger adults who were at lower risk. That was in part because Americans were already in worse health and more vulnerable to the virus's toll. The United States' obesity rate is nearly double the average of peer nations. Around a third of United States adults have had multiple chronic conditions, the highest rate among our peers, according to the Commonwealth Fund. rates for conditions including hypertension and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease have held relatively steady in recent decades, and the rising prevalence of diabetes is in part because people are living longer with the disease. Many preventable chronic diseases are related to four major risk factors: cigarette smoking, excessive alcohol use, physical inactivity, and poor nutrition. In the United States, people get less exercise, moving less than some European counterparts, studies have shown. The nation's Western-style diet is heavy in sugars, processed meat, and unhealthy fats. Americans also consume more ultra-processed foods, surveys suggest, and such diets have been linked to increased risks of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and some cancers. The fractured United States health system also contributes to our lagging health, researchers say. Unlike other peer nations, the United States does not guarantee health care coverage. We spend more per person because prices are higher, and Americans are more likely to report skipping care because of costs. We also have fewer doctors per capita than many peer countries, data does show. The United States is arguably the best in the world at treating complex diseases, says Dr. Philip Langgren, director of the Global Public Health Program at Boston College. But it is worse at providing access to care and services that help manage or prevent illness, he said. And now, something questionably related. Ozempic for everyone, doctors hail GLP-1s. Should Ozempic be added to the water supply? That is the kind of half-joking question that doctors kick around when a new class of drugs begins to help a big chunk of the population. Cardiologists used to quip about spiking water system with cholesterol-reducing statins because of their ability to prevent heart attacks. Now, Ozempic and others in the GLP-1 category of drugs are approaching that critical mass. They are showing promise for an ever-expanding list of diseases beyond today's most common uses of weight loss and treating diabetes: heart, kidney, and liver diseases, sleep apnea, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, alcohol addiction, even aging. Some of these are potential benefits that obviously need further study. It is getting to the point of wondering what GLP-1 agonists aren't good for, pharmaceutical researcher and blogger Derek Lowe wrote in the journal Science last year. If this trajectory continues, doctors say millions more people would benefit from them, maybe even one-third to a majority of adults. But they also caution about use of the drugs in people who do not medically fit the bill because it could cause malnourishment. Doctors would have to figure out ways to guard against excessive weight loss in people who aren't overweight, perhaps putting them on special diets, said Dr. Scott Isaacs, an endocrinologist in Atlanta. The drugs, which also include Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Zepbound, mimic naturally occurring gut hormones such as GLP-1. The medicines promote production of insulin, which helps control blood sugar levels in people with type 2 diabetes. They suppress appetite and make people feel full faster when eating, helping overweight people lose pounds. In diabetes and obesity alone, the eligible patient population is more than 100 million American adults, or 40%, have obesity. About 38 million have diabetes. Many of the proven and potential benefits of the drugs cascade from their effect on obesity. Losing weight relieves sleep apnea. It takes pressure off the joints, helping with arthritis. You treat obesity, all the complications of obesity that we spend a lot of our time treating in medicine should get better, said Dr. Luis Aron, director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Center at Weill Cornell Medicine. But it also seems likely that some benefits are independent of weight loss, possibly because of anti-inflammatory effects of the drugs. The science is evolving very quickly, and understanding how these medications affect so many organs and inflammation, said Dr. Robert Kushner, an obesity treatment specialist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Doctors say GLP-1 type drugs may help with psoriatic arthritis, an autoimmune condition that causes joint pain and skin rashes because of weight loss, but also for the potential to reduce inflammation. Susan Abernathy of North Cove, Washington, started taking Eli Lilly's diabetic drug Mounjaro back in 2023 to help treat her psoriatic arthritis after older treatments were not working as well. The 58-year-old chief operating officer of a nonprofit credits Mounjaro with helping her lose weight and relieving her joint pain. She takes it along with Taltz, which is approved to treat psoriatic arthritis. Her insurance pays for the combination in part because she also has type 2 diabetes. After about 4 years of not being able to run and do things, I've been able to do a couple of 5Ks again, she said. I can walk longer on the beach than before. Lilly is studying the combination of Taltz and Mounjaro's main ingredient to treat psoriatic arthritis in a phase 3 study. Doctors are also seeing success in treating people with certain liver diseases. Isaac prescribes GLP-1s for people with a fatty liver condition called metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis, or MASH, which is estimated to affect 15 million Americans. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine back in April found that semaglutide, the main ingredient of Ozempic and Wegovy, improved the condition in patients. Another area being considered, Alzheimer's. Researchers believe GLP-1s may have neuroprotective effects, slowing loss of brain volume. A small study in the UK last year found that Novo Nordic's GLP-1, liraglutide, slowed cognitive decline versus a placebo. About 137 million American adults, more than half of the adult population, are eligible for treatment with the GLP-1 drug semaglutide, based on having type 2 diabetes, meeting the threshold for excess body weight, or having established cardiovascular disease and excess weight, researchers estimated in a paper published in JAMA Cardiology. In comparison, about 82 million United States adults are eligible for statins. But only a fraction of those eligible are currently taking a GLP-1 drug, about 8.3 million in the United States this year, T.D. Cowen estimated. The percentage of the eligible population taking a GLP-1 outside the United States is even smaller. Global uptake of weight loss drugs is minuscule relative to the addressable market, T.D. Cowen analysts wrote in a research note. Still, some people clearly shouldn't take the drugs. I do believe that a large percent of the population, but not everybody, is going to be able to get some benefit, Arone said. People with a history of a type of thyroid cancer or with certain head and neck tumors should not take them because earlier studies showed the drugs caused those types of tumors in rats. Some doctors are reluctant to prescribe them to people with a history of pancreatitis because some patients have developed severe cases of that condition. And some doctors shy away from prescribing them for cosmetic weight loss when no other medical conditions are present. Use of the drugs will surely grow. Morgan Stanley analysts estimate that by 2035, the number of Americans using a GLP-1 for obesity alone will rise to about 29 million. But even that would only represent 20% of the eligible obesity population. That's partially because anti-obesity drugs are expensive. List prices are over $1,000 a month. Many insurance plans don't cover them, and even manufacturer discounted prices are still several hundred dollars a month. Tolerability and manufacturing capacity of the drugs might also be issues. Some patients stop because they do suffer unpleasant gastrointestinal side effects. And now, Billy Joel's last moment of obscurity. The opening act, a 24-year-old singer, was struggling for the audience's attention. This was at the Kyle Opera House in St. Louis on the night of December 3rd, 1973. The Beach Boys were the headliners, and try as he might, the young singer could not get the crowd to listen. The rudeness was so evident to the reviewer from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that, feeling sorry for the performer, she wrote of him, Billy Joel, a not untalented singer-pianist, that unfortunately, the audience treated him with the indifference that customarily goes to anyone but the name act, even though he clearly deserved an attentive audience. 2 months later, on February 2nd, 1974, the same singer returned to the same stage. This time, a Post-Dispatch critic wrote that even though no one listened in December, now the audience rewarded his excellent performance with three standing ovations to bring him back for two encores. What happened in those 2 months? His song Piano Man captured the nation's attention. His career was on its way. In the decades that followed, he would sell some 150 million records worldwide and headline sold-out shows in the biggest arenas and stadiums on the planet. Very recently, Mr. Joel, 76, and having suffered a recent fall on stage, announced that he is canceling his scheduled concerts this year and next. He has been diagnosed with a rare brain disorder that can affect balance, vision, and hearing, and impair cognitive function. He apologized to his fans, though they will surely find the apology unnecessary. Thinking back to those months in St. Louis in 1973-74, when he went from being ignored to receiving ovations, I contemplate another singer who shared the stage with him on his evening of triumph. Harry Chapin that night performed his heart-stirring Mr. Tanner about a hopeful singer whose spirits are crushed by a cold and devastating review. He goes back home to the laundry where he has long work, never sings again. Lyrics, excepting very late at night when the shop was dark and closed, he sang softly to himself as he sorted through the clothes. Music was his life. It was not his livelihood. And it made him feel so happy. It made him feel so good. And he sang from his heart, and he sang from his soul, and he did not know how well he sang. It just made him whole. What must Mr. Joel have been thinking that long ago February in St. Louis as his fellow performer sang those words? What must he have thought, having felt invisible in December, about what lay ahead now that Piano Man, in a symbolic yet eternal sense, had saved his life? Your music can do that, whether heard by tens of millions of ears or only by your own. Your music can make you whole. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.